Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, cracking up at my goofiness, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Seriously, guys, if you could hear our pre-show and post-shows, you would think that the goofy stuff we do during the show is nothing in comparison. Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, let's start this episode off with a little listener mail. This listener mail comes from Jacob, a.k.a. Booger. And Jacob gave himself that nickname. I'm catching up to the present day podcast and am on USB versus FireWire. And I still haven't heard you guys mention AMD yet. Please talk about them since I think they're better than Intel in more than a few ways. Thanks, Jacob Booger. Well, Booger, we thought we'd talk a little bit about kind of microchips in general and how they're made. We don't tend to break things down to company by company, but of course, Intel and AMD are both known for their microchip architecture.
Yeah, they for the uninitiated, these two are pretty much the big guys in the computer segment, like the personal computer. Intel and AMD are wrestling back and forth with one another on a day-to-day basis. Now, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of other companies who make microprocessors of different kinds.
Right. Let's be fair.
Yes.
When you say wrestling, Intel's kind of the enormous sumo wrestler, and AMD is like the luchador.
Yes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that in this case the luchador is, you know, a lesser.
Oh,
human
no.
Being.
I'm just saying by market share.
Okay, yes, by market share, yes. Intel has the lion's share of the market. But there are many, many other microprocessor manufacturers out there. You know, some of whom are limiting their work to one or, you know, one or two different products. You could find microprocessors in just about everything, anything that's electronic these days, because we've come to rely on them.
Yeah.
So we also
had another listener ask us about microchips, and I would like to apologize to that listener because I could not find your email and or tweet. I know that you sent it to me, and so we wanted, and this listener wanted to know what microchips were, mm-hmm. and, you know, what they did and how they were made. And so we were going to kind of talk about a little bit of what they do, but not a whole lot because we've talked about it before.
Yes, we have.
But a microchip, you know, when you hear that term, you might think, well, what the heck is that? Technically, it's an integrated circuit.
Yes.
That's mm-hmm. what a microchip is. And so if you remember when we talked about the basics of electronics and electronic theory, a circuit is a pathway for electrons to flow through.
Yes.
And of course, the flow of electrons we know better as electricity.
Mm-hmm. At least that's the current definition.
Oh my gosh. I totally forgot that we went down that road last time. All right. So yes, a circuit is a pathway for electricity. Integrated circuit is a special kind of circuit. Now are we going to take the Wayback Machine here, or you want to just talk about the past?
We could just talk about the past.
All right. So,
I don't think anybody gassed up the Wayback Machine.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed the last time I was pulling the cord, it wasn't really starting up the way you would expect it to.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, back in the day being long time ago, circuits were much larger than they are today. You could actually see each of the discrete elements pretty clearly because, it was all on a much larger scale. And, we're going all the way back to vacuum tubes here.
Oh, yes.
I'm talking about.
Okay.
So vacuum tubes, acted the way transistors do now.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's talk a little bit about what exactly they did. The whole purpose of it was to control the flow of electricity. It would be to allow electricity to flow through that part of the circuit, and you could even use it to amplify the electricity if you needed to.
Okay.
You're just staring at me now.
Well, I wasn't planning on talking about vacuum tubes, so I didn't prepare
right.
that part.
Well, at any rate, the problem with vacuum tubes is they were really big and they produced a lot of heat.
They do produce a lot of heat.
Yes.
I can tell you that right now. I have a beaten up old amplifier that uses vacuum tubes. And not only do they produce a lot of heat, they're really heavy and unwieldy because they take up a lot of space.
Yes. So those are all problems, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you've got – it produces a lot of heat, takes up a lot of space, and they're really heavy. So the early computers were these enormous machines that generated – so much heat that it was hard to be in the same room as them. And of course, it was hard to be in the same room anyway because they pretty much took up an entire room.
Well, put it this way. You're not going to see a vacuum tube powered iPod anytime soon because they take up a lot of space.
Right. So
you can't put that in your pocket.
Yeah. No, you can't.
That and in fact, the development of the semiconductor was what led to, you know, transistor radios. And that's when we started getting a lot of portable electronics because it was possible to throw a portable radio in your pocket instead of, you know, having to deal with the one that was plugged in, you know, at home on the desk.
Right. The one that was almost the same size as the desk it was on.
Yeah.
So vacuum tubes were limiting us quite a bit, because of their size, because they would also burn out.
Mm-hmm.
And if one burnt out, that meant that your whole system was no longer working and you would have to replace the burnt out tube. So we needed to find something that was smaller, generated less heat, was more reliable, and that ended up being the transistor.
Yes.
Now, that was invented back in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
It would still be quite a while before we got transistors small enough to put them on like a circuit board. Mm-hmm. The earliest transistors were actually pretty large.
Yeah.
And then, even then, you're still talking about a bunch of discrete elements that you wire together to create a circuit.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, if you've done this, you might have a physics class that you've done where you've created an electric circuit this
mm-hmm.
way,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you're using wires to connect various elements together, and then you hook it up to a battery.
Mm-hmm.
So,
if you haven't, you should, because it's a lot of fun. And it's a good learning experience, but that's an aside.
Right. So,
Sorry.
Yeah, I know. Now I'm thrown off. Now I'm like, okay, wait, let me look at my notes.
Notes.
So let's talk about the complex circuits here.
Okay.
There was an issue called The Tyranny of Numbers.
The Tyranny of Numbers.
Have you heard about this?
Wasn't that a mystery novel?
No.
Oh.
Not. Well, I mean, I'm going to say no. It could be true.
I'm going to write it if there wasn't one.
Right. Gotcha. No, here's the definition. Advanced circuits contained so many components and connections they were virtually impossible to build. This problem was known as the tyranny of numbers.
Hmm.
So that, in other words, we get to a point where we can build circuits, right? But in order to build them at the complexity that we need, the tools we have are too crude,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Building it by hand is just, there's no way you can have the level of precision you need in order to build a circuit that small.
Right.
What could possibly be the solution to the tyranny of numbers problem?
Let's see.
We've mentioned it before already. The integrated circuit. Just say the integrated circuit.
Okay, the integrated circuit.
Very good. So in 1958, you got Jack Kilby.
Yes.
And Kilby was working at Texas Instruments.
One of those aforementioned companies that makes lots and lots of different kinds of microprocessors.
That's correct. And Kilby at the time was brand new to the company. You know, he had only been working there for a little while and mm-hmm. had not earned any vacation yet. So there was a point where pretty much everyone went on vacation except for Kilby, and he was left there pondering the tyranny of numbers problem. And he came up with this idea. He thought, well, what if you were to build an entire circuit out of one piece of material?
Mm-hmm.
And you would essentially carve out the different elements that you would need out of that material, overlay it with some metal to be the connectors, and then you'd have an entire circuit printed, more or less, on one single piece, and you wouldn't have to build the individual elements.
Mm-hmm.
That's so the idea behind the integrated circuit.
I apologize.
No, go ahead.
So essentially he found a way to make the whole thing fit in a much more compact space.
Right. And by using this method of carving away from a single element, a single chip, mm-hmm. really, you could make the different individual parts of the circuit much, much smaller than you could before.
Right. Which is good. Because it has led to lots and lots of very, very small devices.
Well, this is what eventually led up to Gordon Moore taking a look at the number of transistors that engineers were able to fit onto a single 1-inch diameter chip,
yeah.
and say, look, at the time, I think it was every 12 months
yeah.
they were doubling. Although, of course, today we talk about it being every 2 years. So Moore's law has slowed down over time, but you're still talking about doubling over a set time limit, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Cause you know, we're in the billions now. So, first of all, I guess we should talk about the material they use to build these chips. It's silicon.
Yes.
It's not just silicon. It's extremely pure silicon.
Yep. As a matter of fact, when I was doing research on this, I found a video by a different part of our company.
Yes.
The Science Channel did a piece on silicon, and it's really fascinating what they do, because they have to melt down lumps of the material to get, you know, basically to reform it in the shape that they need for microprocessors. But it has to be extremely pure, so they have to clear out the chamber with argon gas to make sure that there's no air in there at all.
Right.
Melt it down, and then they create essentially what looks like a giant silicon pencil.
Yeah, it's a big cylinder. Yeah, cylinder of silicon. And then they put this cylinder through they use a very fine wire to cut wafers.
Yes.
It's wafer thin.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, it's just a few millimeters thick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Each layer.
Right. So they cut these slices off, and each slice becomes its own silicon wafer that you use to imprint circuitry onto. And you could end up using one wafer to produce dozens and dozens of chips.
Yes, as a matter of fact, every once in a while you'll see a picture in the news of some dignitary visiting a computer plant, and they'll hold up a what looks like a giant disk. And you're going, wait a minute, that's way too big to fit in my computer. Well, yes, this is a cross-section of that giant cylinder imprinted with, in general, the ones I've seen where they show it, where they're holding it up. There, you can see that there's something etched on the silicon. Well, those are all the different individual chips, or what would become chips if they were, you know, uncontaminated by whoever it is holding it up.
Right. At the end of the process, once everything's been printed, you chop that wafer into the various actual individual chips.
Yep.
And by chop, I mean you actually use a very fine saw.
Yeah, it's a diamond saw, as a matter of fact, that they use to cut the slice of silicon up into lots and lots of little chips. But we've skipped a whole bunch of stuff.
All right. So,
The process is known as photolithography.
Right.
And it's been in use for several years. By several, I mean many.
It's actually kind of a neat idea. All right. So let's start with, you've got your silicon.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go ahead and say where this stuff takes place, because we're talking about, elements on these chips that are just a few nanometers in width.
So any kind of impurity, any mote of dust that got on this thing is going to ruin it.
A mote of dust would be enormous compared to one of the transistors on these chips. So
exactly. So
you can't have any sort of dust in there. Well, think about your environment for a second. Just the dust in the air alone in your environment right now, unless you're in a clean room, is going to be way too much to ever try and produce a microchip.
Yeah, so at least one that will function.
Right. And we're humans. We give off lots of dust, dead skin cells.
Yep.
Tons of dust every day if you look at the entire human population.
Yes.
Literally tons of dust. So these clean rooms can't have that. They don't have the luxury of being able to have that sort of dust flying around. So in order to prevent it, they have massive air conditioning systems that circulate the air in these clean rooms. These clean rooms can be enormous, by the way, like the size of a warehouse.
Yes.
But in most of them, the air conditioning system is so powerful that it can completely circulate all the air in that room under 10 minutes.
Yep.
It's pretty impressive.
And, this is where Intel's famous bunny suit campaign came from back in the 1990s.
Sadly, not the kind of bunny suit I was thinking.
No, the bunny suits are actually they look like they're in some sort of high-tech firefighting gear, because they're suits that they wear where they have hoods over their heads with a visor in them. And this basically keeps dust out of the air by, you know, if you seal
keeping
in the humans.
Inside, yeah, it keeps it inside the suit.
Seal off the humans, then they can't shed inside the clean room. So.
Yeah, and I remember in that video you were referencing, they actually talk about how the air in these rooms is cleaner than the air you'll find in hospitals.
That doesn't surprise
me. Because of the way, the speed and the filters that they use. Mm-hmm. So we've got this environment that is... It's not dust-free, because you're never going to get that unless you're in a complete vacuum. But it's about as limited as you possibly can be and still be on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about the actual process of photolithography.
Yeah, but as we get into this, you're going to see that we have improved on Dr. Kilby's process. I'm assuming he's a doctor. I didn't see that part.
Yeah. He's an engineer at any rate.
Yeah. On Kilby's process for creating microchips.
Right.
Because this is a very, very sophisticated way of doing it.
Right. So you start with your pure silicon wafer.
Yes.
That you have sliced off of the whole the cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing you need to do is you need to create a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Now the mask is, and this is not in all forms of lithography, but we'll get into that. The mask is essentially a pattern.
Yes.
Right? It's the pattern of, it's what the chip is supposed to look like at the end.
If you've ever worked in photography and with film, not with the digital camera, and you are trying to make part of the picture a little darker when you're developing it, you would hold up something basically to block the light from getting to that part of the to the photosensitive paper. Well, that's basically what the mask is. It's blocking light from a very high energy ultraviolet source, which is going to shine onto the silicon wafer. And the mask is blocking that. Now, why would we do this? Well, it's because the silicon is not just silicon at that point. They have also overlaid on top of that a piece of photosensitive film.
Right. Right. So you've got this you put the photosensitive film on top of the wafer, and then you've got this this mask that that ultraviolet light shines through.
Mm-hmm.
When the ultraviolet light contacts the wafer, like there's going to be some parts that the mask blocks and some part that the mask lets through, right?
Right.
So the parts where the mask lets through the light hits the wafer. And when you are finished with this first process and you wash the film away, it takes anything that the light has contacted gets essentially carved away.
Well, basically what happens is that the high energy ultraviolet light causes that film to break up. The film doesn't react to the light very right. well. So that's the point. They wash it with water and that washes away the broken away bits, but you still have that protective film on the places where the light didn't touch because of the mask. Well,
You're right. Yeah, I worded it incorrectly.
Well, that is... No. I was just clarifying. And then once they rinse that away, they bake it.
Right.
And then they use a process called etching, in which they use chemicals to dissolve the remaining protective film to basically, now you have just the etched wafer of silicon.
Right. So
there's no more film there.
And also the stuff that was no longer covered by the film, which had been, the film got zapped away wherever the light touched it.
Yes.
That gets etched away.
Yes.
So that's where you've actually carved away the material. And what's left standing is the stuff that was not touched by the light.
That's correct.
That's just one round. You may have to do this dozens of times before you have actually carved out all the elements on your circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, there's another part of the process too, the doping part, in which they change the electrical properties of the silicon.
Right. Doping means that you are purposefully introducing impurities into the material in order to change the way it either conducts or insulates. I mean, that's what a semiconductor is. Under certain circumstances, it can conduct electricity, and others, it does not.
Right. Or it can conduct some electricity, but it not at a rapid rate,
right.
as rapid as it would
or
flow.
Or maybe at just certain temperatures.
Exactly. So
again, this all depends upon the impurities that you introduce mm-hmm. into it. So at the base, you have to have the pure system so that it doesn't conduct electricity at all. Otherwise, you do have a chip that's not going to work. Because,
right.
again, the ultimate goal here is to be able to direct the flow of electrons in a very specific way. And, of course, if your entire chip does that, if it doesn't – if it's not specific at that point, and so you'd have a broken chip.
Mm-hmm. So they, as Jonathan pointed out a moment ago, they continue to do this layer by layer by layer so that, again, you're taking up less space because you have layers of material on top of one another. Which, it no longer requires it to take up so much physical space because it's all basically sandwiched on top of one another. But then there's the metallization process.
Right. So you've carved away everything that doesn't need to be there.
Right.
It's kind of like a sculptor.
Yeah, it is.
You carve everything away that doesn't look like a circuit.
Very nice.
It's essentially how it works.
I'm on board with that.
But again, it's on an incredibly tiny level. And the reason it can be so tiny, we've talked about before that the nanoscale is so small that you cannot view it through a light microscope.
Yes.
Well, that's because they're not using the way they can get it this small is they're not using visible light. Again, they're using ultraviolet light.
Yes.
And in fact, Intel is using a process called extreme ultraviolet lithography in their latest processors, which are the ones that have like the 32 nanometer transistors, which is crazy.
I figured they were building microchips sliding downhill on a street luge.
You're wrong.
And then pulling tricks. No?
No.
That's not extreme?
Not that extreme.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not going to be in the X Games. But so the metallization,
cool.
This is where you've built all these elements by carving away the stuff that doesn't belong.
Yeah.
But you still have to connect them together,
mm-hmm.
right? This is normally where you would be building wires. Well, the way they build wires in these transistor or in these circuits, it's actually kind of similar to the process we just described, except what they do is they put a layer of metal on top of the wafer, and then again you put this UV sensitive photoresist on top of that metal.
Yep.
And you have another mask this mask is going to block out all the places that where
you don't want wiring.
Actually, it blocks out the places where you do want wiring, right?
Oh, right. Yes, so, you want the places you want protected.
Yes,
and want to remain.
Yeah, so it'll block light wherever it blocks light. That's where a wire is going to be. Wherever light comes through, that's going to carve away this metal. So again, you go through another process where you run it through the system. The light ends up hitting the designated areas on the wafer, and that ends up going to breaking down the metal so that you are left with just the wires that you want.
Mm-hmm.
You've carved away everything you don't want. Again, you may have to do this process several times because in order to get all the connections you need, you may need to do several layers mm-hmm. of wires.
Right.
Up to, I think, 5, I think was the last I had read.
Right.
But it's, again, very similar to the lithography process of actually carving out the chip itself.
Yep. And see, there. This is all very cool, and it has led to a number of, all kinds of different chips that are getting smaller and smaller and allowing Moore's Law to continue more or less. Except, you know, for the laws of physics, which make things difficult.
Well, I mean, it's already made things difficult because remember when I mentioned the extreme ultraviolet lithography?
Yes, I do remember when you mentioned that.
Yeah, because it was just like 3 minutes ago or something. So here was a barrier that Intel had to find a way. And I know that I'm probably ticking off our listener who wanted to hear about AMD and not Intel. But Intel had a problem when they were going to switch to EUV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those fundamental things. The wavelength that they are using, the EUV wavelength, is at 13.4 nanometers.
Wow.
Okay, at that size, that is so small that practically every material absorbs it. So if you were to shine it on anything, it's just going to get absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily work if you need it for lithography. They found that if they used the EUV in a vacuum and they used reflective surfaces instead of lenses to focus and direct this light, they could then use it in lithography.
Wow.
And there's also another form of lithography we can mention, which is the electron beam lithography.
Yes.
Now, in this case, if you were to use electron beam lithography, you can get very, very, very precise and build these incredibly tiny structures. And you don't need a mask. You can just put it through a computer program and the computer program will direct the beam properly so that you don't have to build the mask for the light to shine through. However, it's a much slower process than photolithography, so it's not really considered a viable alternative for the mass market right now.
Right.
But you were talking about reaching the physical limits of size, which doesn't have anything to do with necessarily our manufacturing process.
No, that's true.
It has to do with very fundamental physical laws on the quantum level.
Right. At a certain point, those dividers in between the pathways that electricity travel down, once they get to a certain point, the electrons are going to be able to pass through them, and that's going to cause a serious problem.
Yeah, it's called electron tunneling, and it's a really... To read a description of electron tunneling is really, really bizarre. Because imagine that you come up to a wall,
mm-hmm.
all right? You're
yes.
standing on one side of the wall. You lean against the wall, and then suddenly you're on the other side of the wall. You didn't necessarily pass through the wall. You just started on one side, and you ended up on the other. That's kind of like electron tunneling. It doesn't actually move through the material. It just – it's so small. The material is so thin, the electron – it acts like there's nothing there.
It might as well not have been there in the first place.
Right. So that's the problem is if you build these components too small,
mm-hmm.
then the electrons are no longer controllable. And again, just like in the situation where I said if the entire chip were to conduct electricity, it would not work.
There's
same
no point.
Sort of thing. Yeah, you can't direct the electrons if they can pass through everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in that case, we will have to look at alternatives to the transistor.
Yes.
And there are lots of engineers working on this problem. Sometimes they find out by switching to a different material, they can actually get a little smaller than they expected.
Mm-hmm.
which Intel found out when they switched from one kind of metal that they were using in their chips to a different kind.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually we are going to hit that limit, and it's not going to be that long from now. But that doesn't mean that we won't find a new way to work around the problem.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure it won't be long before we know something anyway.
Yep. So that's how microchips are made. We kind of talked about what they did. And, you know, there are several different companies that produce these, like Paulette was saying. It's not just for computers. It's for all sorts of electronics.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, for a company with this long and storied a past as Texas Instruments has, for example, you know, that you just don't – they don't make chips for computers that end up on people's desktops, at least not anymore.
Right.
But yeah, AMD is one of those companies that has had a hard time getting a toehold in the consumer desktop market, partially due to, you know, just the fact that they're you know, trying to get out the 800-pound gorilla, or maybe 800-ton gorilla in the case of Intel, because Intel was one of the very, very first chip manufacturers to make microprocessors for home and work computers.
Yeah, they also made some very shrewd partnerships.
Yes, they
with
did.
Various companies, which actually has gained them a little trouble in the court systems for anti-competitive behaviors.
Yes, that's true.
But that's a totally different story. Maybe what we should do is put down on a podcast list at some point the story of Intel versus AMD.
That would be fun.
That would be a good way to put it. That would be less technical and more kind of political, but it's an interesting story.
Businessy.
But I have something else we can talk about very quickly.
Okay, what's that?
It's a little listener mail. This listener mail comes from Chris. Now, Chris says, this, by the way, was directed not just to tech stuff, but to stuff you should know. You smell, and you started this war. Why would you ever be so unwise as to start a war with tech stuff? This is a war that you cannot win. This is a war you will not win. We expect your surrender to be handed to our leader, Jonathan Strickland, in the form of a sticky note with the words, "You win," written in black Sharpie. We expect your surrender soon. And then there's some French, which I'm not going to attempt to say because je ne parle pas français bien malheureusement. But this is from Chris. Now, Chris, it comes down to this. We're gonna just shoot straight here. We like Josh and Chuck. They're nice guys. We even like Stuff You Should Know.
Yeah.
I listen to it. I'm a fan. They do good stuff. Occasionally, they pull us on.
I used to be on the show.
Right. So our rivalry is mostly funny. And the only reason I'm saying this now is I don't want it to spiral out of control. Because just the other day, I noticed that Chuck was not his normal chipper self. And it turns out he's worried that people don't like him. I mean, earlier today, I found him weeping in the corner, sucking his own thumb.
Why and would you
someone
tell
with,
that?
I know, well, I mean, it's probably, he probably wouldn't want me to share that, but his psyche is weak, people. I'm just saying, they're not
so
made
cool.
of the stern stuff that Paulette and I are made of. You know, we are like Teflon. It just slides right off us. But Josh and Chuck, they're like teddy bears. Emotionally vulnerable teddy bears.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
Thanks for writing, Chris. If any of you would like to write us, our address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. And we have a cool fan page on Facebook now. So if you're on Facebook, do a search for Tech Stuff. Join our fan page because we're trying to build up a nice, strong community, have more interaction with our fans. We always like that. And we also have our own Twitter feed.
Yep. We decided to have a Tech Stuff podcast Twitter feed now. So instead of just following Jonathan and I individually, you can follow us together.
Right. The handle, by the way, is TechStuffHSW. So just go to twitter.com/TechStuffHSW and you'll find us there. You can also find both Facebook pages and Twitter pages for the other podcasts on How Stuff Works.
Yep. So if you've been putting off tuning in to some of the others because you just hadn't had a reason, now you got a reason. They're right there, people.
Yeah. Check them out. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
If you're a Tech Stuff fan, be sure to check us out on Twitter TechStuffHSW is our handle, and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TechStuffHSW.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.